This is On the Other Hand. A podcast that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, and Braver Angels is part of a national organization that aims to reduce political polarization by promoting honest and respectful dialogue among people of all political beliefs. Our progress as a community and country happens when we actively seek common ground with the other side so that problem solving can occur. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works with others in the community who may have differing views from their own.
Hello, and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, Glenn White, here with my co-host, April Chatham Carpenter. Get ready for today's conversation as we learn how community leaders in Arkansas are helping work towards solutions. So, April, who do our listeners hear from today?
Well, Glenn, our guest today is Caroline Stevenson, and Caroline is a longtime active community leader in Central Arkansas. She has several areas in which she's served as an effective and dedicated advocate, including mental health and peace and advancing interfaith relationships. And I know I'm looking forward to having Caroline fill us in on how she has worked to advance these causes and what motivates her efforts in community service and in advocacy.
I am too. So Caroline, welcome to On the Other Hand, and I appreciate your joining us for our podcast. So let's start with this. Let's get to know a little bit about you. Tell us just a bit about yourself and how you got to this point in your life.
Well, thank you, Glenn and April. I'm really excited about being here. A little bit apprehensive. I've not done one of these before, but okay. So the way I arrived at where I am now, I told Glenn one time, it's from being around for a lot of years and having a lot of experiences that have led me here. My story is probably pretty personal because it's due to the experience of my children and that I got involved in the areas of mental illness and then later in the area of peace and justice. And because my oldest son developed a major mental illness when he was 18 years old and had that for the rest of his life, I became involved with a small group of family people at that time. This was the latter part of the 1970s that were frantically trying to find answers to the issues that plague families about major mental illnesses. So I got involved in that area for a good long time. And then my second son, my middle son, was on a flight from London to New York when that plane was bombed in 1988. So he lost his life in that because of situations with Doug. They had settled down some. I became really involved and interested in peace and justice issues, and that's pretty much where I have been since.
Well, that's quite a story. Not many people can say they've had those many difficult challenges in their life, and particularly to have two sons to be affected, to lose one that way is pretty amazing. I wonder, let's start with kind of the issue with your son with the mental health issues. I wonder how much of an impact you feel that the stigma of mental health has. I suspect you've faced that a lot. What have you learned about how people view mental illness and the stigma associated with it that has impacted you and others in similar situations, and how have you handled that?
Well, I can honestly say that things have changed radically in the many years since Doug became ill. And mental health is something that people seem to not have so much trouble discussing. You know, I think a lot of PTSD situations have helped to destigmatize mental illness. But I will go back to, say, the early 80s when there was so much stigma involved and so many things that seemed to point to families and, this is what causes mental illness and a lack of scientific understanding, research about the brain. That has changed so much with the ability to look at the brain, through MRIs and everything and see what actually scientifically is happening in the brain. But back then, there wasn't much of that, and struggling to find answers, a lot of it pointed back to families. This is the problem, and if we can solve the problems of family dynamics, we can take care of mental illness. So it is a drastic change from the early days, I would say.
That's good to hear. I think you're right. There have been some advances. It's still around, but better than it used to be, and you would know better than any of us. So, you were talking before about some of your earlier efforts in mental health, and do I understand correctly that you were instrumental in helping start the National Alliance for on Mental Illness chapter here in Arkansas? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can. Well, a small group of families started meeting, and this was happening all over the country. After deinstitutionalization of hospitals, patients were put out on the street with virtually no place to go, and families were trying to figure out what in the world to do. We met for a long time, and then we talked with one another and called our sessions woe sessions because that's all we knew to do. And then we became more involved through Fred Guggenheim, actually, who was head of the Department of Psychiatry at the time at UAMS, offered us office space at one of the buildings in at UAMS. And so we actually set up an office and started developing chapters around the state. At one time, we had like 13 or 14 chapters in the state. From that, we really meeting together and talking with professionals who were also very helpful at the time. We established the Arkansas Alliance on Mental Illness. And at some point, a few years later, I ran for and went on the board of the National Alliance on Mental Illness and became chair of the membership committee. And so I traveled quite a bit at that time, helping other states and other local chapters get started around the country. So it was a really exciting time. Lots of advocacy for research on mental illnesses were part of what we did, helping families cope with having these serious problems within their families, and advocating strongly for support systems to provide for people out in the community and to urge community mental health centers to take on these strong issues.
So, if I'm understanding you correctly, then it sounds like the Alliance on Mental Illness actually got its start in Arkansas and then it went national. Is that correct?
Not really, Glenn, because what was happening in Arkansas was happening all over the country at the time. As I
Okay.
mentioned, after deinstitutionalization, families all over the country were scrambling to get help. So these local groups were forming, and what I think we were instrumental in doing is pulling all of ours together or helping start chapters and then pulling them all together to have a state organization to better advocate the legislature and the mental health system in Arkansas. So that was the vision that I took with me when I went on the national board, was to pull all of these local groups together.
And so I had not heard about your story about your son on that that Pan Am flight, and I think that that also led you to doing some work that was trying to bridge relationships across the interfaith divide and the peace area. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, because my son Doug, who had the mental illness, was getting wonderful care after many years up in Minnesota. He was up there, and so I could kind of turn my attention to other things. And when Sandy, my son, was killed, I got to know Jean Gordon. If you know Jean Gordon, you know that she has had an influence on a lot of people. And she was the founder of Arkansas WAND, Women's Action for New Directions. And the mission of WAND is to empower women to act politically, to reduce militarism and violence, and to direct excessive military resources to unmet human and environmental needs. I made myself learn that because it was what really motivated me to get involved. And WAND had a profound influence on this community and other in the state. So that's been a big part of what I've wanted to spend time on.
Yeah, so what kind of work have you done with that organization?
Well, I was looking back. Thank you all for prodding me to look back on what all we did in WAND. Early on, we did a lot of peaceful protests at the time of the Iraq War and the beginning of the Afghanistan conflicts and all. And so we held a lot of those, but we also brought in some wonderful speakers to investigate nonviolence and particularly how we spend our national budget. And so much of what we spend on militarism, we felt would be better spent on solving conflicts and providing help for people. We brought in Erica Chenoweth, who had written a book talking about how much more effective civil resistance is to militarism and violence. And Lamy Gobi, who was a Liberian peace activist who was, oh, she was so influential in helping to stop the Liberian Civil War. And another Israeli peace activist we had. All of those people spoke at the Clinton School, and we were really proud of all of that work that we did. We also brought in other peace activists, John Deere, who wrote many books on peace activism. One that particularly meant a lot to me was The Beatitudes of Peace. So those are some of the things that we did.
You know, I'm curious because you could have turned that tragedy that happened to your son into bitterness or vindictiveness. Instead, you turned it into kind of activism on your part for a different kind of way of dealing with peace. How were you able to manage that internally for yourself?
Oh gosh, I really don't know. I accept that I know that I don't do well with depression, and so I didn't want to go that route, and I just I guess just naturally felt that, you need to turn your life experiences into something meaningful, or you waste away in bitterness. And that didn't appeal to me at all. So activism, I remember when I was a little girl, bullying was just something that I didn't like at all in any form or anything. So I think it's just naturally been a resistance that I have to people being hurtful, so it seemed natural to turn to peace organizing and advocacy. Just seemed like the natural thing to do.
It may be natural, but I tell you what, it's not, it doesn't strike me as anything that would come easily to most people, because as April said, most people are going to automatically have a lot of animosity and turn into a retribution kind of mindset. So it's remarkable that you went that way. Can you look back and think of any values that you developed early on that urged you in that direction?
Well, I don't want to imply that I wasn't angry, that I wasn't, I had those thoughts of vindictiveness, and I think those things are natural as you're processing what's happened to you. If you stay there, that's what's detrimental, I think, to your own mental health, and doesn't really move anything forward. I think I was influenced by my mother, who was not at all an activist type person, but she was never one who promoted any kind of, she was just a peace loving person in her own life. She was never gossipy about people. I think that she was a strong influence on me. And then other people that I saw, I'm an Episcopalian and go to a little Episcopal church, and I think that I grew up thinking that I could question authority, I could question what was going on around me, and so it was never like I had to take a back seat or anything to what was happening. I could make my voice known. And so those values, the value that I saw in my Christian heritage, it seemed very simple to me that Jesus was a person who didn't like bullying, for one thing, and didn't like the oppression of marginalized people. It was that is just a simple thing to me. All of the theology around religion kind of goes away in my thinking, and it's the basic principle of trying to make peace and bridge divides.
So Caroline, when it comes to your work on interfaith relationships, I'm thinking about what happened with your son in the Pan Am bombing. It was a Muslim extremist terrorist that was responsible for this. And we've had so many years of, being familiar with the idea of the Islamic terrorist, to the point where a lot of people in our country have grown suspicious and even hateful of anyone of that faith. And yet you have found it within yourself to reach out, of all people, toward the Islamic community and form relationships. So I'm wondering if you have any words for people who might be skeptical, at least, about those relationships and the possibility of living peacefully and coexisting with people who are not Christians and of that faith. Dave, do you have any thoughts for us?
Well, it boils down to getting to know people again, and understanding that with all religions, there's extremism. I don't care what religion it is. When I studied Buddhism, I thought it was because you couldn't justify, killing in Buddhism, but I found that even there, people have a way of justifying what they want to do. I think we've got to break down the idea that one religion has some preference over other religions and that ours is the right one. And I guess that's it. I want to say one more thing about the bombing of Pan Am 103, and this is a little bit different take on it. In July of 1988, before Pan Am was bombed, the United States Navy vessel Vincennes shot down an Iranian Airbus and killed 290 civilians. Supposedly, and I guess it was by mistake, there's a lot of confusion about that. But that was 6 months before the bombing of Pan Am 103. And that has never been brought fully forward to understand that even accidental violence can perpetuate, can cause a reaction. And so, I can't hold the Muslim people to any higher account than I can hold us for having killed 290 Muslim people 6 months before that. So that's I guess my answer to why I have a love of people of the Muslim faith that are peace loving, and that's my answer, Glenn.
Caroline, one of the things that I think that you've done, I have not heard actually about it, but Glenn told me about it, and so I'd love for you to tell our listeners, is to some interfaith work with the Muslim and Christian communities. You bring up your Christian faith there. I'd love to hear more about that kind of work that you've done.
I think we're very fortunate in Little Rock to have several different organizations that have promoted interfaith dialogue and interfaith understanding. I started some years ago going out to the Islamic Center and getting to know some women, particularly out there. And I really like that. I like sitting in on services. And then I attended the Buddhist Center for a number of years and really benefited from that. And in WAND, we had women who were members of the Jewish faith, the Baha'i, just a number of different denominations. So that's always been important to me. In terms of working with people of kind of diverse backgrounds, I had not been able to have a lot of contact in the last 20 years or so with people in the Jewish community. And that was really important to me because the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been a really, really sad thing, in my opinion. So, about a year and a half ago, I asked a person that I had just barely known if she would meet with me and we would talk. Well, as of this morning, we just on Monday, we get together for an hour and we walk and we talk. And that has been just a very meaningful experience for me. And I thought we would talk about the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and I would convince her of her ideas, and she would convince me of hers. And what has happened is we've gotten to be really close friends. And we found so much in common. We have in common having had a family member with a mental illness. And, you know, it's just so easy when you spend the time to get to know somebody really closely.
The humanity outweighs everything in terms of the differences that you have, finding that common ground. That's beautiful, Caroline. And it sounds like that's something that you've done personally, just even seeking out, going to those different places to learn. That compassionate curiosity that you have, I can just tell even in your tone of voice as you're talking about those relationships. So, you know, when you're working with people who have different views, varying views on different issues, I'm wondering, you know, not all folks agree with compromise, or they don't at times feel like talking to the other side is even helpful. You've talked about some, you know, that you've built relationships and friendships. I'm curious as to if you have any concerns about working across these differences, whether they be political or other kinds of differences.
Well, my concern is that it's really tough to be able to do that politically, particularly in the political environment that we're in. And so I find it sometimes easier just not to bring the subject up with friends who have such strong differing opinions and try to, you know, maintain friendships. But it's important to me that we're able to talk with one another. And I gotta tell you, I've not been very successful in the political arena in talking about domestic issues and all that. I gotta say, I'm not very successful in that.
Well, you had told me the other day something, if you can share any of that about this attempt to discuss with people of different political views. Can you tell us anything about kind of how that went, what kind of problems you ran into? Were there any successes at all?
Well, a few years ago, a couple of my friends and I decided that we would put together a little conversation group, and it would be three of us that leaned blue and three that leaned red. And the people were all politically connected and, you know, had pretty definite ideas. Now, this was like 10 or 15 years ago when the political divide was not quite as great as it is today, but we did have several times when we got together and tried to develop a rapport that would allow us to move into more political discussions. And that lasted two or three, 4 months that we got together. And then it just kind of went by its wayside. And I don't know. I don't have an answer for how to make that happen.
Well, you know, that's something that we try to focus on in Braver Angels, is ways to have those conversations and to make them productive and respectful. So that's why we, you know, do workshops and try to teach things like communication skills and conflict resolution. You know, we use some of those things that have been found in research to be helpful, and we try to teach other people how to use that. But at the end of the day, it starts with a willingness and a little bit of courage to undertake that conversation. And it doesn't go easily, and most people are very frightened of the prospect of talking with someone with strong beliefs on the other side, because it has gotten so ugly lately. So I applaud those of you who tried and made those efforts.
Well, we didn't know about Braver Angels at the time, or we should have.
No, it wasn't even in existence until late 2016.
I see.
Yeah. Well, you know, since we're talking about politics, I mean, you've mentioned the terms red and blue, so you're familiar, but in Braver Angels, as you probably know, we talk about red representing kind of the more conservative, right-oriented way of looking at things, and blue being the more liberal or progressive. And then we also got to talking about, you know, purple. Maybe there's even green for environmental, but purple, where people, and that's where a lot of people wind up being in our experience. They have some of both. So I want to kind of see if you can kind of tell us what your color is. Where are you on that spectrum?
Well, in all honesty, I would have to say I'm pretty blue. And I was a Republican. Growing up, my family was more leaned toward Republican, although we didn't discuss it a lot. My dad did not like unions very much back then, so he would talk about that. But otherwise, we didn't talk politics very much. And so when Winthrop Rockefeller came to Arkansas and started developing the Republican Party, I was all in for that, and really felt like having just the Democratic Party in Arkansas was limiting. So, but at a certain point, I just lost interest in being a Republican and felt that the Democratic Party was more, maybe I was more aligned to that in terms of racial issues, particularly in Arkansas. So I think that influenced me a lot. And so I've worked for candidates, particularly in the Democratic Party, and some recently with Progressive Arkansas, Arkansas Progressive Women's PAC, to try to get more women, progressive women, involved in running for office.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us for this edition of On the Other Hand. We hope you enjoyed the first part of today's discussion with Caroline Stevenson. Be sure to check out the second part of our conversation with Caroline, as well as our other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand, on the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braverangels.org/podcast, or on your favorite podcast site.
And April, we'd love to hear from our listeners. Any feedback about what you like about our program, and particularly ideas for speakers or topics, or just whatever you want to share with us. And you can email us that at otherhandar@gmail.com. And there's a link for that on our website, so you can do that as well.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter,
have a good evening, and let's all work to bring our community closer together.